Like many wildlife photographers, my next guest grew up with the smell of the outdoors in his nostrils, a passion for watching wild animals in their natural habitats taking the place of the usual kids' hobbies. But unlike most amateur animal photographers, Lindsay McRae progressed to being paid for his passion and winning awards for it. For the past decade, he's travelled the globe, including spending a year in the company of emperor penguins in Antarctica, filming for David Attenborough's BBC series Dynasties. He missed the birth of his first child while there, but won a BAFTA. He's written about his unforgettable time on the ice in his first book, My Penguin Year. After news of the recent collapse of the second largest breeding colony, Lindsay reflects on the challenges the emperor penguins face in the future.
It's not that actually the species, it's the habitat in which they rely on. So very few emperors actually touch land. Most of them live their life on the sea and they breed on the frozen ocean, the sea ice. And as the planet's warming, the sea ice isn't stable enough for long enough, really. Each winter for their chicks to reach an age where they can swim. So I think the next few years are going to be critical to see, you know, how much the planet does warm and how quickly the ice melts.
Are you feeling optimistic or pessimistic for the emperors?
I'd like to be optimistic, but I'm worried.
You write about hoping to take your children to Antarctica one day. Is that still a dream of yours?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got two boys now, but Walter, who was born while I was down there. Penguins have been such a big part of his life, and I'd love to give him the opportunity because so few people get it. So I'd like to think one day I can get him down there.
Do you hope that with Dynasties and the Emperor Penguins program, part of that you made, that it had such a massive audience internationally, that it's going to educate people, maybe encourage people to take some kind of action?
Yeah, I like to think so. It's such a difficult place to get to, Antarctica. It's so remote and so expensive even for tourists, and even if you can go, the seasons are so short because nobody can get there in the winter because of the weather. But everybody knows what an emperor penguin looks like. It's probably the most, you know, charismatic creatures on earth. You know, everybody knows them. So I like to think that we've sort of exposed their life a little bit more, and people are now more aware of, you know, the challenges they're facing.
Well, before the penguins, which of course we'll come back to, there were badgers in your life and other wildlife. It was part of your growing up.
Yeah, I was, I'm not sure what it was. I was brought up in the rural Lake District in the north of England. And yeah, like every child, was obsessed with wildlife. And we had a badger set just a few minutes up the road from where I lived. And that's where I spent every evening. And yeah, that's what really forged my passion.
We don't have badgers in New Zealand. We're a bit short on mammals, as you probably know. What are they like?
They're big. I remember the first couple I saw, actually, because they're known for raiding people's bins at night. Obviously, they're nocturnal. But when you get to know a family, and especially in the rural countryside, they're fantastic, and the cubs are so cute. They're silver, obviously, with their black and white faces, and and they very easily get used to your presence if you're with them all the time. So yeah, I had three or four cubs playing around my feet most evenings, and obviously we have bluebell woods in the spring up here. It was beautiful, and I haven't actually seen it. I don't get much chance to watch badgers nowadays, but yeah, I remember those days fondly.
Well, in a way, you owe them a lot, because it led to the career that you've had, springboarding off that. You contacted a BBC show called Spring Watch. This was the start of everything for you, really, wasn't it? But that first approach, they gave you an offer you couldn't refuse.
Yeah, I sent them a letter saying that basically the premise of the series is every year it's a 3-week live event, and every evening they broadcast live from a certain location in the UK. And I thought they could come up to where I lived and that could be their location, because it was so rich in wildlife. They couldn't do that, but what they did offer me was making a film about me watching the badgers. So up to that point, I'd had no interest in photographing or filming wildlife, but with them lending me a camera to film the badgers, that was the start of it, really. And I realized the possibilities I could create with this little piece of kit. So yeah, that was it, really.
You took it very seriously, didn't you? I mean, you put a lot of thought and effort into creating that little film.
Yeah, it was bizarre because even though I was only given the camera just to film a few shots of the badgers each evening, I started filming everything that I could see. And I actually had to give that camera back after a couple of weeks. And then I was cameraless, but it was almost instinct creating TV. And I was watching wildlife through my binoculars, and I'd be letting animals fly into my binocular vision and then letting them fly out, almost as if I was creating a television sequence. So it was weird. It was instinct for me.
How did you come then to get your own camera?
Well, I started saving up money because I knew I was desperate for one after that. And I actually got enough money for a stills camera. So rather than one that filmed wildlife, one that just took pictures. And I remember my mum saying vividly, you know, you hang on. We'll get you enough money to get you a video camera. And thank God she did say that, because I got a little bit more and she ended up lending me the rest. But that was me buying my first video camera that really kicked my career off, I suppose.
Well, you're quite focused. You talk about leaving school at 18, and it feels like school just wasn't the life for you. You had a hankering to get outdoors. Do you think there was a moment that you decided, actually, filming wildlife, that is going to be what I want to do, and school's not going to help me with that?
Well, yeah, I was a bit weird. I went to the same school from the age of 2 to 18. I never changed schools, and I loved school. But I think by the time I got to 18, I just realised I didn't really want to be sitting inside for much longer. By that point, I knew I wanted a career in natural history filmmaking. But you sort of never expect it to happen. It's one of those crazy jobs. You know, it's the dream job, and nobody thinks they're ever going to get the dream job. But I did have a few contacts in the BBC at that point. And luckily for me, in that first year out of education, one of my contacts offered me a job. And all I was doing was making cups of tea and the shopping for Springwatch, actually. But it was a foot in the door, and I got to meet more people. And that was the key step forward.
I imagine you're so used to watching animals, you were watching people and learning. So even while making cups of tea, it's a classic story, isn't it, from tea maker to filmmaker?
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, but you will have learned a lot talking to the others, seeing their approach to filming?
Yeah, it was, you know what, just watching people, because I'd spent my youth, well, in classrooms, and I suppose biology was the closest I could get to learning about wildlife in school. But even that, it was all very human based. There was nothing about animal behavior, and I was learning all I could on my own just through watching wildlife. But then you get to work alongside the people that are already in the industry, and immediately you pick up things so quickly. And yeah, just a couple of weeks is worth so much more than, you know, a couple of months in a classroom.
Well, your career kicked off as a freelance. What an exciting life you led. You went all over the place. What were some of the highlights of those freelance years, those early freelance years?
Well, I started off filming British wildlife, but very quickly started getting offered abroad trips. And I went to Alaska and Canada to film grizzly bears and wolves. I went to the Brazilian Pantanal, probably the most richest wildlife area I've ever been to. And it was just the dream, traveling the world and seeing such, you know, incredible wildlife. But that dream of Antarctica was still there, but you never expect it to happen. But, you know, with all these other trips, I was seeing, you know, some amazing sights.
Well, you mentioned Brazil, of course. That's just had all the fires going through. That must have been heartbreaking for you.
Yeah, we weren't in that same area when I did travel. We were in the Pantanal, which is a big wetland. So not as many forests as the Amazon, not as many trees as where the Amazon is, but still, yeah, you wonder what the air is like now.
But tell me about opening up your email that has a subject line called Big BBC Film Trip, because this is the start of this part of your life.
Yeah, well, obviously being freelance, you never quite know what's coming your way. And usually it's just an email. But this was, yeah, this was strangely vague. And it was from somebody who I knew well. I'd grown up knowing Miles Barton was the producer, and I'd grown up knowing his name. So, yeah, immediately I was intrigued. And, yeah, it was a phone call with him that led to the offer of going to Antarctica.
Well, they weren't wrong in saying it was a big trip, and you had to negotiate with your partner. And you're right, it's really quite moving how she's in the business, she understood, but you'd had a lot of time apart. And I think when you're breaking the news to her that it wasn't going to be, you know, 2 months or 3 months or 4 months, that was a pretty tough conversation for her.
It was tricky. And I struggled writing about this in the book because I remember that time vividly, because she knew it was my dream, yet, you know, we were together, we had commitments, and I didn't want to leave her, but equally I knew I couldn't turn this opportunity down. She obviously didn't want me to leave, but she knew I couldn't turn this opportunity down. So it was a tense couple of weeks, but I'm extremely lucky to have Becky, who, yeah, is now my wife, and she fully understood and was on board and said, you know what, we can work around this, so let's go for it.
I imagine the pregnancy was a surprise, was it?
Well, it was and it wasn't. We'd spoken and we were desperate to have children. We'd been together 6 or 7 years at this point. And we thought, so before I went to Antarctica, I knew I was going 2 years in advance. So if you include the year I was down there, that's 3 years in total, which if we were going to start a family, it was 3 years to wait. So we thought, you know what, we'll try and see what happens. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. If it does, well, let's see. And yeah, fortunately it did. And we'd spoken about it. And I think because it was our first, we didn't quite know what to expect. And that not quite knowing what was coming, I think, helped. It was going to be a new experience for both of us, and the experiences were just going to be separate. So, yeah, it was a surprise, and it did put a whole new spin on the trip. But I was committed at that point, and we just knew what was coming.
Well, let's look at the mission, your mission to Antarctica, and this, of course, related to Sir David Attenborough's Dynasty series. Did you sit down and have a big conversation about the goals from this 11 months on the ice?
Yeah, we did. We had several meetings and so much preparation as well, because being isolated, so not being able to leave Antarctica for 8 months, we had to be completely self-sufficient. But story-wise, with the penguins, it was interesting, because the life cycle of an emperor is so well known. We were having to try and do things differently to make the film look new and imaginative. And we went through all the pieces of behavior that we were desperate to capture. But still, you know, a lot of what happened in the final film, we just came across and we were quite lucky with. But we sort of had a good idea before we went down of what we wanted to come back with.
Of course, the hook, if you like, of the Dynasty series was being able to identify a matriarch or a patriarch. Is that difficult in the penguin scenario, given that it's a colony? I thought perhaps it's a little easier when you have a pride of lions, for example, you know, which is manageable. But we're looking at a colony, and they all look, let's be honest, pretty much the same.
Yeah, no, and the BBC never hid that. That was... rather than the lions or the chimpanzees, where they were following an individual family, we were following the colony, if you like. That was our family, because you're right, they are identical. There's only certain times of the year you can distinguish males and females, but the rest of the time you don't know who's who. So they especially during the winter, they rely on each other to survive. So it is one giant family, if you like.
How did you prepare for this?
Well, it was a lot more thorough than I envisaged. We did a couple of weeks on a glacier in Austria, where we were in similar conditions to Antarctica without actually having to travel down there, and we'd be pulling ourselves and our teammates out of crevasses. Lots of GPS and survival training, first aid training. We actually did a firefighter training course, because should the station we were staying at set alight, we were the only people there that would have to put this fire out. thorough medical checks, because obviously they don't want to be pulling you out if you're if you fall ill. I mean, you still can fall ill, but they want to be sure that you're in top physical shape. So yeah, it was incredibly thorough, but yeah, it did make me feel slightly easier knowing that they were going to such lengths.
I guess what you couldn't prepare for was A, the remoteness and the duration of being in that remote state.
Yeah, that was a strange one. We arrived in the summer and there were about 60 people on Neumayer Station where we were, because the summer season is quite short. It's from the end of, well, beginning of November through to the end of February. And there's lots of people there. It's quite a busy place. But then come the end of February and that last plane leaves, there was just 12 of us left. There was my crew of three. So myself, a television director and a field assistant. And then the German scientists who are there every winter, or a team is there every winter. They're different individuals, but that includes a mechanic, a chef, a doctor, an IT specialist, an electrician and a couple of scientists. So, yeah, just 12 of us. And I was waiting for that day wondering, you know, up until that day, I could have got home. But as soon as that last plane leaves, you're stuck. And I was slightly nervous about that day. But when we reached it, we were all very excited. You know, we were being abandoned, if you like, at the bottom of the planet. But it was more exciting than it was nerve-wracking. But obviously, that was it then. I knew there'd be no getting home until beginning of November.
Well, a bit like the Emperor Penguins. You know, you were a family and you relied on each other. That's just how you describe the penguins, really, too.
Yeah, absolutely. We lived obviously in the same building. We couldn't leave other than just to step outside. And like we were filming the birds. So we had to get on. And thankfully we did. You know, we're a real tight knit group of friends now. And we had a great time. And yeah, I think we'd have struggled if some of us didn't get on. But, you know, we were a great team.
You open the book with that sighting of the birds' little black dots then coming into view. The spectacle playing out in front of me was exquisite, you write. I thought I might get you to describe that moment for the listeners. I mean, it's quite beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, funny at the same time, the way you describe with the little pilot.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we've been waiting for the sea to refreeze, so the penguins' breeding landscape to reform, so they could... Actually, they had somewhere to stand on the ice for a good few months at this point. And we've been traveling every day to the edge of the ice and looking out over this enormous patch of water. And the previous week, the sea had started to refreeze. And all of a sudden, there was this enormous layer of ice. And yeah, just one day, which was in early April, I think late March, early April. And at that point, the sun is very low in the sky. It's only sort of above the horizon for a few hours over midday. And that's autumn, obviously, like we're in the northern hemisphere, you're in the southern hemisphere, so this is the same for you. And yeah, the sky was pink. There was this shimmer in the air, like a heat haze, but in cold air. It was bizarre. And yeah, just these almost hovering above the ice, these black specks sort of just appeared on the horizon and they just never stopped. And all of a sudden there were thousands making their way towards us. And it was almost as if they'd all decided to return at the same time. Very quickly, they'd made their way across the ice and were marching their way underneath us. We were on top of an ice cliff. We weren't down on the same ice as them. But yeah, it was sort of the sight that myself and my colleagues had dreamt of. And knowing that so few people have ever seen it, it felt very special.
Well, you can plan in a way for it, can't you? But when it happens, it's always going to strike you, but you're there for, you've got a job to do as well. So at the same time as you're marveling at this, you've got to get the shots. This is your one chance. You can't restage it.
Yeah, absolutely. And even though we were getting stunning pictures, but it was quite frustrating because the sea ice was relatively fresh and we weren't sure how stable it was at this point. So we weren't going down onto it at all. We were stuck up on the top of this ice shelf. So yeah, it would have been nice to get closer to the birds, but because of not being sure if we'd fall through the ice or not, yeah, we stuck to the top. So from a filming point of view, quite frustrating, but still, you know, we were seeing the most incredible sights in front of us.
Are emperor penguins camera shy?
No, not at all. They, in fact, the majority of the birds that we were filming have probably never seen a human. And I'd set up the camera every day when we did get down to the colony, and you'd turn around and there'd be three asleep next to your camera just before you start filming, and they're incredibly inquisitive. And if I knelt down, they'd look me in the eye. They're big birds, so I like to think that they enjoyed our company as much as we enjoyed theirs.
You're very mindful too, though, of not interfering with the birds. You know, that's part of what you do as well. Keeping your distance as much as you can.
Absolutely, yeah. We had rules to follow, and I think one of the rules was keep your distance at about 30 metres. But that's very tricky when you've got individuals that just come cruising over to you every day you get down to the colony. So yeah, we knew we weren't disrupting them in that respect. But it was nice to be close to them, and yeah, they're fantastic and so beautiful when you see them that close up. They're just perfection in every respect.
Yeah, there's a lovely photograph of you sitting on, it looks like a tripod or something similar, with a coffee in your hand, and a penguin chicks come up and looking at you. They are adorable.
They are probably the cutest animals in nature, yeah.
Well, let's have a look at their breeding season, because that's, you know, of course, largely what you're looking for. And I think even courtship doesn't always go smoothly. There's a lot of rejection in the colony.
Yeah, it's... It was interesting watching them pair up, and we'd done a bit of research on this, and they don't have the same partner every year. They simply haven't got the time to be looking for the partner they had the previous year, because they need to get breeding as soon as they return. Like I was mentioning with the global warming aspect, they want to use as much of that time as possible. So most of them actually pair up within 24 hours of returning to the colony. But we followed a few birds marching their way through the colony and trying to find a partner. And their displays to each other when they do finally bond are just stunning. It's this mirror image of each other, and they stand incredibly tall. They just stretch up as high as possible and then crouch back down again. And the height difference must almost be a couple of feet when they're stretching and slouching. And they show each other by extending their necks. They show each other their golden neck patches, and just copy everything that they do. So if one preens its tail, the other will copy. If one scratches its wing, the other will copy. And they swing their necks round in this mirror dance. And it's beautiful to watch.
Mating on the ice, how does that go for them?
They're clumsy birds at the best of times out of the water. They're perfectly designed for motoring through clear ocean, you know, Antarctic Ocean waters. But on land, they're clumsy at the best of times. So you can imagine mating when a female has to drop down and the male climb on her back. Our colleague, Stefan, my field assistant, he described it as a penguin trying a surfboard out. But a very quick affair, but they often ended up just falling off and rolling to one side, bless them.
Well, clearly, you know, the breeding happens despite that technique, and it's underway. But they pair for a season rather than for life. They're not like, say, the albatross.
No, correct. Yeah, they find a new partner every year, but they stay with them obviously for that whole season. And how they recognise each other's, when they separate for certain parts of the year when each goes off and to feed, and then they come back to this colony. And our colony was about 11,000 individuals, and how they recognize each other just through their calls was unbelievable.
But that's the reason. I mean, with so many, they simply don't have time. You're saying this is quite a quick affair. They don't have time to try and find their partners every year, after time.
Absolutely, yeah. So obviously they don't know how long that sea ice is going to last before it melts and breaks up again. So as soon as they get back, that's them starting, trying to max out on as much of that time as possible.
And they don't build a nest either, which is unusual for birds. And understandable, because they're surrounded by ice, of course.
Yeah, their nest is their feet. They lay their eggs directly onto the ice, the females, and they did so in about May. We'd actually lost the sun at this point. The sun had set for the last time, and where we were, it disappears for 62 days each year. They laid their eggs after the sun had disappeared, and the female very quickly passes the egg to the male, and that's where it stays. It stays on his feet, tight against his skin, And that's him incubating it for the next 62 to 65 days. So, yeah, that's their nest, and the males just shuffle about.
Well, that manoeuvre that you just described of the female passing the egg to the male, it's difficult, and it's, I mean, potentially fatal if it goes wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Temperatures at this time of year were sort of below minus 40, so incredibly cold, and it wouldn't take, you know, any longer than 30 seconds a minute, and that egg would just freeze. So, yeah, they've got to be very quick, and thankfully, a lot of the birds that we saw transferring the egg knew what they were doing, and we didn't see any that got spilled, but we did see the odd discarded egg, so I imagine it happens.
And the males, of course, during that incubation, they're going to lose body weight, and they have to keep body warmth for themselves and for the egg. So they do this, what, by getting together with the other males?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the female actually producing the egg took almost half, I think a third or a half of her body weight. She was really thin after she laid her egg, and you could clearly see the strain it had put on her body, and she disappeared. But at this point, the males, they haven't eaten for a couple of months at this point. They're still enormous and look stunning, but obviously they've still got the winter to get themselves through. And yeah, like you say, they huddle and they rely on each other to keep warmth. And that's where I say that, yeah, they rely on each other, especially those cold days. I think when they do huddle, there can be up to 10 birds per square meter. So for a big bird, they take up, you know, relatively small amount of space on the sea ice. But packing together like that is, well, they have to do it for survival.
Well, when I look at those images, I always wanted to be I'd want to be the penguin in the middle of the huddle, not the one with part of me exposed to the outside.
Yeah, absolutely. And we regularly saw, you know, even in minus 40, minus 50 temperatures, that huddle was so effective that birds in the middle would get too warm and the whole thing would break apart. And you'd see these enormous clouds of steam rise into the sky. And you really got a sense of how effective it was. I think in the huddle, it can be 36, 37 degrees, whereas outside the huddle, it's minus 50, minus 60 degrees. So, yeah, incredibly effective.
I'm talking to Lindsay McRae, who's written My Penguin Year, Life with the Emperor is a Journey of Discovery. Lindsay, I want to come to a moment that got a lot of publicity, a lot of discussion when Dynasties came out in this episode with the emperors. And this was when you and your colleagues came across a large group of the penguins trapped in a ravine. And this is testing for you and your colleagues, because generally, your role is to film and not to intervene. Talk us through this, because, you know, you write about it in some detail and it was very painful. I mean, emotionally painful for you all.
Yeah, you're right. We'd been with the birds about 10 months by now, and this was late September. Being with them 10 months, they felt like family. We'd spent every minute of every day that we could with the birds, and we'd become incredibly attached to them. And we'd return to the colony after the biggest storm we'd yet to experience. The storm had lasted about 2 weeks. It just seemed as though it was never going to end. And wind speeds were close to 100 miles an hour, and temperatures had dropped again to minus 40. And we knew the birds had taken a big hit during this storm, but obviously we'd not been able to get down to them. This clear day arrived, and you wouldn't have believed the weather we just experienced, because all of a sudden the sun's high in the sky. There's not a breath of wind. It was beautiful. And we got down to the birds and it was just carnage. There was just, unfortunately, dead chicks everywhere. Adults running around looking for their chicks, chicks that had lost their parents running around looking for their parents. But also, like you say, there were these deep ravines in the ice that the wind had created. And at the bottom of these ravines were groups of emperors, and a lot of these emperors still had young chicks on their feet. They were the ones that were in the most trouble, because having a chick on its feet limited the full use of their legs. But we very quickly saw a couple of birds decide to sacrifice their chicks and be able to use their legs freely and climb out. And for birds that didn't have chicks, it was easy scaling these near vertical walls. Believe it or not, for an emperor, it was quite unique seeing them climb in this way. But to have rescued themselves, their chick was going to die, and we simply couldn't let that happen anymore. It was a rather unique situation, because at this time in Antarctica, there's no other animals there. Emperors are the only ones that stay for the winter. And it wasn't as if they'd been driven in there by a predator. And there were certainly no other animals which would have benefited from a group of dead penguins effectively at the bottom of this gully. So we thought, you know what, we'll do what we can and we'll give them an option. And that's what we did.
You grabbed the shovels and you dug out. Did you have to have, though, I mean, you're all deeply affected by this, of course, have a conversation, a debate about whether you should or not, or was it by that point instinct?
Well, I think for all of us it was instinct, but we did have, so we spent that day filming and working out what was happening, and then actually we were forced back to the station for another day because more bad weather came in, so it wasn't until we returned. So we did have a day to talk about it. And yeah, we simply couldn't have walked away and known we'd not done anything. So yeah, we grabbed our shovels and all we could do really was dig into this slope and create a more shallower ramp, if you like, up the side of this slope, so they could shuffle up with their chicks still on their feet and make their way to safety. And what we did really was help them indirectly. They didn't have to use this ramp. We obviously hoped they would. And I remember looking back across at these birds thinking, you know, do you know what we're doing? Do you know we're trying to help you? Anyway, we finished the ramp and we walked away and we turned around, and within 30 seconds, a minute, the first bird made its way over, and that was it really. One bird, the rest followed. And yeah, it was an incredible feeling watching them make their way back to the colony, because they certainly wouldn't have survived at the bottom.
I read that Sir David Attenborough said he would have done exactly the same thing.
It was nice to have their support and the support of the producers back in back at the BBC, because we were the ones that were on the ground and we were the ones making the decisions. And I think it was going to be controversial either way. If we didn't do anything, then people would have asked, why didn't we do anything? So it was one of those, but I think we made the right call.
And you make the point that you didn't go into the ravine and lift them out. You gave them an option and they saved themselves. And that's very much how you see it, isn't it? You gave them a chance.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, they're incredibly intelligent. And we'd learnt how intelligent they were throughout the year. And I'm sure that they were looking back across at us thinking, you know what, they're giving us a way out here. Let's use it. And they did, yeah. They shuffled their way up and it was fantastic to watch.
You filmed some other incredible scenes, including a kidnapping, and I've heard of this and seen this with other penguin species, kidnapping chicks. It's like having a chick they're so driven to have a chick. They go to extreme measures, including taking somebody else's.
Yeah, their maternal instinct is so strong, and we knew this behaviour existed, but we never expected to capture it in such detail. And in fact, the one we did manage to film was the only one we saw, and it happened right in front of me. And it was actually the first pair of adults that were transferring the chick. So just like when the female gives the male the egg in the autumn, this is the opposite. So now the chick has hatched and it's now the male giving the chick back to the female. With the male stepping away and leaving the exposed chick on the ice, the female very quickly, you know, ushers herself up to put the chick on her feet. But that split second was enough for birds that had lost their young, and they were straight in onto this chick. And I remember following the chick with the camera, seeing it desperately trying to get its way to safety. And only after about 30 or 40 seconds did an adult emperor shuffle its way towards me with the chick on its feet. But as soon as the mayhem slowly subsided, I could see that the two adults which were originally trying to transfer their chick between them had nothing. And yeah, the chick had been kidnapped. And I mean, we don't know the fate of that chick, but I'm sure it wasn't good with a bird that wasn't its real parent.
How did you cope with the icy extremes? We've been talking about how the emperor penguins managed, but what about for you guys for that length of time? And it got so cold.
Yeah, it did. I remember in the autumn when the temperatures, it's funny, you sort of get to minus 25 and you're all right. That's all right. That's bearable. But as soon as you get to minus 35 and below, that's cold. And our first minus 35 day, I remember talking to Will and Stefan, my two colleagues, and we were the ones out on the ice all the time. And I was saying, this is autumn and it's minus 35. How on earth are we going to cope in the winter? And I was amazed actually how my body got used to it. And even though it was extremely painful, it was bearable. But still, you know, days on the ice were extreme. And I'd be sat down quite still, really, for long periods trying to capture the birds, doing certain events, and nothing would warm me up. You know, you'd jog on the spot and you'd go for a little walk away from the birds and then back again. And yeah, it was, it's funny, I forget what it feels like now, but I remember the days, and I certainly don't think I'll ever feel cold like that again.
You were so conflicted when those 11 months came to an end. You were so conflicted. You had a baby son to go and meet and visit for the first time, and yet leaving, despite all the storms, despite all the grief that you suffered when the birds you love so much went through those tough times. It sounds like you could have stayed even longer.
Yeah, it was strange. You go through the middle of winter and you have these long storms and the darkness, and I think because you can't get out, all you want to do is get home. You want to see your family and friends, and you want to be back with my wife. But as the season progressed and you've got chicks running around and the weather improves, you start to feel more comfortable again. And it's a very easy way of life down there. We've got very used to it. Obviously, time doesn't exist. Money doesn't exist. Everybody helps one another. There are no borders. It's a fantastic place, and it's probably the most beautiful place on earth. And I was obviously desperate to get home. I had Mol Walter to meet, my little boy. Obviously, Becky I hadn't seen for 11 months. The rest of my family. But yeah, knowing that this whole trip was coming to an end, and there's a real possibility, you know, I'd never see these things again. Yeah, it was tricky leaving, and even now, Becky, my wife, she's come to terms with knowing that she'll probably never quite understand what that feeling was like. Yeah, so I think with emperors being the animal I've spent the longest time with in my life, I'll probably never see another one. I mean, I'd like to think I'll get the opportunity to go back down there, but there's a real chance I never will. So, yeah, that was difficult coming to terms with.
I was reading also in the book that as a cameraman, you handed over all this material to the producers of Dynasties, but you didn't really know how it was going to look until later on. It's an interesting scenario for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it goes. We do our job and then we hand over the material, and that's that. It's down to somebody else then to do what they can with it. So, yeah, I remember seeing the finished film maybe only a month before it went out on television, and yeah, I think they did a fantastic job. We were down there obviously for the 11 months, and you do the best you can, but you can never really envisage what the final film's going to look like. And yeah, I was extremely proud when they put it all together.
Lindsay McRae, My Penguin Year, is published by Hachette.